This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Flee to the Mountains. Book one, the Sanctuary Ranch series, and the author is Donna J. Benson. And Donna joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Crossbooks. Hello, Donna.
Hi, how are you today?
This is a riveting kind of fiction based on maybe what's really going to happen in the future, or, you know, to some degree or another. We know the country is in bad shape, on the brink of chaos, you say. And, of course, we have the terrorism threats and the persecution of Christians continuing to escalate. We're in all this debt. The government can't seem to get a handle on anything. And people everywhere are feeling it, aren't they?
Yes, they are, very much so.
But a lot aren't. A lot are ignoring the signs.
But I think that that's mostly Christian people who are not Christians. Christians are starting to be aware, and I think through the Holy Spirit they're being shaken a bit to pay attention to what's going on around them. And I think that as they do, more and more people are seeing that we're headed in a very, very dangerous direction.
So when did you start seeing all of this, you and your husband, and decided to write this book? What brought all this about?
About 5 or 6 years ago, we could see the direction the country was headed in, and I wouldn't say we were scared, but we were extremely concerned. And we just started brainstorming between the two of us, and so we started going back and forth. Well, what would we do? How could we prepare? You know, and it's not just preparation as far as physical preparation, as you know, and stockpiling food and things like that. It was spiritual preparation, because we believe that as the country deteriorates, persecution of Christians and people of faith in general is going to escalate to dramatic proportions, and something we've never seen in this country at all, and something the Christian church in America is not prepared for.
Well, there's a lot of terrible possibilities. We can only prepare for the worst, as I always tell people. Prepare for the worst and pray for the best. God is, you know, has all power, but at the same time, history has proven that when nations turn their backs on God, and I think this nation is struggling with their belief in God as in general, as a whole, and so who knows what God is going to teach us, right?
That's correct. And I think it's part of our responsibility as individuals and as believers to take God's word and put it into practice and not just leave it on the shelf on our Bible. And that means reading and studying and preparing our hearts and knowing that God's with us even in the worst of times.
So you have this devout Christians, George and Elizabeth Hamilton, this family that gets a vision from God to prepare for very hard times.
Yes. Yes, they start out, I guess they kind of parallel my husband and myself in the very beginning, because they realize things are getting bad, and they start to prepare. They start storing their food, and they start doing what little things they can. So as time goes on, they prepare as much as they can on their own, and then miraculously they win the lottery. Of course, in reality, that's pretty far-fetched, but in fiction, you could do a lot of things. So they win the lottery, and they start a foundation called Hope Foundation, and they start providing help for food kitchens and different orphanages and places like that that can help when times get bad. So as that happens, they expand their their foundation, and they hire a new employee, and this is Janie. Janie Weber comes into the scene, and she is a devout Christian, and she's hired by Hope Foundation to work with them. And after she starts working, she, too, receives a dream. And as we all know, God uses dreams throughout history and to inform people of things or to prepare people for things. And Janie receives a dream, and she feels the urge to get it all written down, so she does so. And after a mishap, the plans get into the hands of the Hamilton family, and they realize that Janie has received a complete set of plans for a sanctuary, a ranch where people will, a small community of people can live and survive in the difficult, dark times ahead. And so they work together, putting together this sanctuary where Christians, believers, can survive in the days ahead. The book goes into talking about the different things they need to do for a community of that size, preparations for food, what kinds of fruit trees they need to prepare and plant, the pollinators that you need to have, because some need pollinators, others do not. And so planning for those kinds of things all are worked into the book to give people an idea of what they too could do to prepare for the times ahead.
Now, you have got some very strong views about the Christian community, how it sees the future, and how the Christian community is or is not working together.
I have very strong feelings. Denominations have begun or have taken over as being a person's God instead of the God of the universe. Jesus Christ was a uniter. He didn't mean for us to separate ourselves to the point where we're fighting over little tiny points of doctrine. And we need to get beyond all that and start coming together as a community of believers. And we can agree to disagree on the little minor points that are really of no consequence, and agree to work together in the name of Jesus Christ, and who we all is our focus. So, yes, I have very strong feelings about denominations these days.
We really have more in common than we do have differences.
Oh, definitely. As long as we believe that Jesus Christ is Son of the living God, and that we believe that he is our Savior and came to save the world, and we believe that he was born of a virgin, lived a sinless and holy life, was the pattern son that we can look after and be our example, then yes, those things are what we have to focus on. The other little things about whether or not you believe in tongues, or whether or not you believe in the gifts of the Spirit, or whether you this or that or that or this, those things are so unimportant, it just is not necessary to even consider.
Now, there's quite a few Christians who believe in the rapture, and they're going to be just excluded from all the tribulation.
You know, that's a great theory, and that's all I believe that it is. None of us really know whether we'll be raptured out at the beginning of the tribulation period, at the middle, or at the end. There's schools of thought about all. Personally, I want to prepare to live through the entire thing, and I would be so honored and blessed to see Jesus come back on a cloud. But if that doesn't happen and I'm raptured at the beginning, well, then that's great too. I mean, I won't have to go through all of the difficult times ahead. But personally, I believe that we are going to go through bad times, and I believe that we will and we will be tested, and whether our fortitude is strong enough to get through it or not, and whether we're willing to deny our Lord, is something we better prepare to face. whether we say, yay, I'm gonna suffer to the end, or no, I'm gonna turn my back on him and walk away, and because I think that's a choice we're all gonna be given.
And your view is that God expects us to prepare physically as well as spiritually.
Definitely, an absolute definite. I believe that one without the other is foolhardy, because you can be prepared for the suffering of lack of food and such all that by getting food ahead and buying seeds ahead and having a garden and canning and all those things. But what do you do about persecution? And what do you do when your child is dragged off or shot in front of you? Do you blame God? Or are you going to stand fast and say, I know you're not the author of evil, and so I know you're not responsible for this, but evil is responsible, and I'll blame that and not God.
So what are some of the comments you've received from those who have read your book?
The one that really fascinated me the most was a close friend of mine. She read both the first one and the draft of the second one. And she said she liked the second one better. And I asked her why. And she said, because the first one is so goody-goody. People aren't like that. They're just not that goody-goody. And I thought about it later, and I was praying about it, and I thought, you know, but that's the way we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be holy and righteous. We're supposed to take on the likeness of our Lord. We're supposed to be loving and kind to other people. We're supposed to plan ahead and be ready for all seasons in our life. So can it be goody-goody? Yeah, but we're supposed to be holy. And so to some people, maybe that is goody-goody.
Well, of course, as you point out, Christians are supposed to be a light to others, a light in the darkness, and we seem to be struggling with that, and people need to get back to basics, too, gardening and canning. There's so much. Sometimes it seems a bit overwhelming, but a little bit at a time, we can achieve it, can't we?
Yes, I honestly believe that. We started gathering together and buying ahead glass jars. Can you imagine if you really sat down and thought about it, a family who is a family of four or six, how many cans do you have to open every night in order to feed your family? Well, if you have to can all of that, how many jars are you going to need? How many lids? If you have to put a new lid on each and every year for the next 10 years and you can't buy them, how many lids do you have ahead in order to feed your family if you're able to can everything? You know, these are things people have to consider now while they can still get things.
Well, that's for sure. Preparedness is always a key to not being fearful, and it's great to have faith. There's some who tell me, Christians, who will say, the Lord will provide.
Yeah, I've heard that many, many times. In fact, we had a pastor at our house one night, and we're visiting over the book and talking about things to come, and they got very indignant and angry with us. Their philosophy, their idea of Christianity is that God is all-powerful and that he will take care of everything, that you don't have to do anything. Well, you know what? Noah prepared the ark because God told him to. He spent years preparing and readying himself and preaching to people, trying to get them to change their ways, and they didn't listen. But his family was saved because he did listen. And I don't want to be one of those who was warned and then didn't follow through, only to find that now we're all going to starve to death or worse.
And Joseph in Egypt saved his family. Of course, he saved the Egyptians too, but he also saved his family by storing 7 years of food.
Exactly, exactly. And there's so many stories.
Oh, there are, right. Well, this is
exactly.
Wonderful, Donna. You've achieved a great deal here with this book, really trying to help people see clearly. It's always great to use fiction to help teach people, and it looks like you've done it in a great way with George and Elizabeth Hamilton, these key characters. Flee to the Mountains, Book 1, the Sanctuary Ranch series. The second book is already finished, and how many more will come, do you think?
I'm thinking at least one more, if not two. I'm not really sure. We're still doing the editing phase of the second one, and the third one's done, but we kind of backed up and went back to doing some more editing on the second one. So possibly within the next 6 months or so, the second one will come out. So after that, then we'll really get started on the third.
And you can go to fleetothemountains.com. Where else can we get your book, Donna?
It's at Crossbooks, or you can get it at Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble. Those places both carry it, and it's in hardcover and softcover and in ebook, so you can get it on the ebook for your Nook if you'd like.
Thanks so much for being with us, Donna, on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Crossbooks.
Listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready to live La Bella Vita with Dawn Catherine on TogiNet.com. Live La Bella Vita. If you're wanting to know all the beauty tricks of the trade and the latest fashion trends before everyone else, this is your show. If you admire celebrities' beauty and their fashion sense, this is your show. Do you love wine and want to know more about the process it takes to make wine from the vine to the bottle? This is your show. Live La Bella Vita. For more on the show and your host, check out our website, labellavitacosmetico.com. This is the kind of show you can sink your teeth into. If you enjoy traveling and food and family, all with an Italian flair, then you can live La Bella Vita with your host, Dawn Catherine. Wednesday nights at midnight, 11 p.m. Central, on TogiNet.com. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Tao-Centered Schools, and the author is Terry L. Hooper. And Terry joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Terry.
Hi.
Great to have you with us. A veteran teacher, been in the, I guess as they say, in the trenches, so to speak, right?
That's for sure, for many, many years.
Know and been there and know how the system works, and you've got a whole new view of it using this principle of Tao Te Ching. We're going to talk about that. Let me read just a couple things you've written about your book. You say, this book is about using the philosophy of the Tao Te Ching as a foundation for developing a new age school of tolerance and individuality. It suggests a dramatic revamping of what our children learn and how they learn. Well, this whole, I guess, modern education is under scrutiny from the political, from the academic. Everyone seems to have their own view, and one thing, the system is kind of broken, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's very broken. It's it's set up more like a corporation these days. And corporations are more interested in profit and not so much in actually doing good things for people.
So it's a lot of new demands upon teachers taken away from their teaching time of kind of, like you say, creating competition among the students. You're a real critic of that.
Yeah, I think competition doesn't, it sets one person up against another, and in competition there always has to be a loser. So if we put that model in education where it is currently, we end up with children that are winners and children that are losers. And, you know, we get legislation like Leave No Child Behind, for example, that sounds really good, but basically it was a competition-driven model that ranked children, ranked schools, ranked communities, and in order to move up in ranking, you had to knock somebody else down. So to leave no child behind is kind of an oxymoron in that concept, because somebody has to be left behind in order for somebody else to be at the top. And that disservices many, many, too many of our children.
Well, let's talk about your background and how you started studying this Tao Te Ching, and you saw this as a way to really help the education system.
Yes, I've taught for about 25 years and in several different states, as a matter of fact. And as time went on, I watched in the beginning of my career the pendulum swing back and forth from one philosophy of education to another. And us good teachers basically kind of stayed in the middle. We took some from everything new that came down the pike that was good and incorporated into what we were doing. But we had a lot of flexibility to teach the way we thought our students needed to teach. Towards the end of my career, I saw that changing, and it became a cookie-cutter, one-size-fits-all. Here's the model. Everything's based on a test score. And there was no individuality allowed. It took a lot of the freedom away from me as far as being able to look at what my students needed, because kids vary from year to year, and classes vary from year to year, and that was completely taken away. And that drove me crazy. And what I saw more than anything was it wasn't servicing my kids. My kids were just kind of being left in the dust. They were, the creativity, the excitement was gone. It was rote memorization, learn these things, regurgitated on a bubble test. And it broke my heart. And so personally, I was into reading a lot of metaphysical type books just for my personal interest, and when I ran across the Tao Te Ching, and it resonated with me, and I kept thinking the whole time I was reading it and studying it, if I could somehow get these principles in the school, I felt like I could breathe some life back into the system that was missing. And so that started my journey of, let me start journaling some of these thoughts that I'm having. But I found that while I was still teaching anyway, I couldn't incorporate them because the system was so structured and so restrictive that, you know, you could try to do some of the things on a personal level with the students, but there really isn't time. Your time anymore is so controlled that a lot of the individuality, there just isn't the ability to incorporate that anymore. And that drove me crazy. So that's why I started to write about it.
So what is the Tao Te Ching? What are the basic messages of the Tao?
Well, the Tao Te Ching was written thousands of years ago by Lao Tzu, which in Chinese means old man. So we really don't know for sure if that's his name, but that's the name that was given. It's a philosophy of living. It's about, there's 81 verses, and if you think about it, an 8 is an infinite design, it never ends, and 1, so it kind of, has been interpreted to be the infinite one, however you want to interpret that. The messages of the Tao are about harmony, peace, living together, seeing everybody as equal, seeing everybody as valuable, humility, and virtue. And the verses are very beautifully written. They're very poetic in many instances. And the thought is that by using these principles and living with the flow of life versus fighting the flow of life, which is what we do so often, we produce better results. We are happier. More people thrive. And there's more harmony overall in the world.
Well, what about those who might say, you know, we live in an age of competition. Sports is high, you know, way up there on the list. We kind of revere it. And it's so competitive. And then you get into the business world, it's competitive. And yet you're saying that competition hurts education.
I do. And I'm not 100% convinced competition is good for our society either. But it is there. And it's much easier, I think, for adults to cope with the lost side of competition than it is children. I think children, until they reach the adult world at least, need an environment where they can thrive, where they can grow, where they can feel confident to take risks, where they're taught values like respect. Because a lot of the problems that we see in our society today by adults, is this lack of respect, this lack of caring, this lack of connectiveness between us all. I mean, we see it in a natural disaster because it's our human nature to care about one another, to want to help one another. But then the business competition, in many ways capitalistic model, doesn't promote that. It promotes each man for himself, and if I have to step on you to get ahead of you, so be it. And I don't think that belongs in our schools, because I think that inhibits children's curiosity. I think it's frightening for children. I think it inhibits their growth and individuality. And those are the skills that later on in life, as adults, can actually become an asset to them in whatever pursuit they may go after when they you know, get on that, whatever their life path would be, whatever that would be.
Well, it seems today spiritual principles have been taken out of the school. And so this has a spiritual, real strong spiritual feeling to it.
It does. If you want to interpret it that way, you could. It's whatever drives your soul, so to speak. And that can be spiritual, but it doesn't have to be. It could just be a sense of wanting to live in harmony with the earth or with each other. But there isn't really a quote, God component in the Tao. The Tao is very open to that. It's very understanding of whatever you want to view as your source from which you came, and whatever gives you meaning and whatever gives you makes you feel complete. That's kind of the focus. So
right.
It isn't, you know,
it's not religious.
It's mischaracterized as a religion, and it's not.
It's not religious, but at the same time, it's a philosophy. So how would this be incorporated into the classroom?
Well, there's a couple different ways. I have in the back of my book very specifics on how schools would be structured as far as the mechanics go. But from a philosophical point of view, it takes away the you're better than me and whatever. It recognizes that everybody has value. Everybody has strength. So that would have to be a belief system that all the adults in the school, all the way down to the custodians and anybody else, would have to kind of buy into that all children have worth, all children that children are different and that each of their individual differences are of value, and that we recognize that and respect that. And it's also kind of a philosophy of, you know, do you want to be right or do you want to be kind? And so the thought would be, always choose kind. It's a teaching of compassion and of kindness and of teamwork, of understanding that we all better as a whole if we work together versus I'm going to do really good and I don't care how you do type thing. So it's that basic principles. And like I said, and then in the back of my book, if you want to talk a little bit more, I can give you some specifics on how the mechanics of that could work out in a classroom, so to speak.
How does this Tao Te Ching address the technological advances of today?
Well, that's a really big part of, quote, my mechanics. The schools, the way they're structured right now, with one teacher standing in front of the classroom and a classroom full of diverse, multi-level children, doesn't really work. And it shouldn't. We shouldn't be using that model anymore because of our technological advances. We have so many other ways to deliver instruction to children. You know, we can do, well, a real good example is the Khan Academy, which is relatively new. It's video instruction, so to speak. And that's a really good concept that we could do. Children could get initial instruction from these instructional videos, which is very much the same way as a teacher standing up and teaching in front of a classroom. And then they could work with teachers in small groups of kids who are at the same level for further instruction or for evaluative purposes to see if they're, so the teachers could see if the students are understanding. But this concept of one teacher standing up lecturing in front of all these students, some of which who are ready to learn it, some are more than ready and past it, and some aren't there yet, that kind of doesn't make the best use of instructional time. We need to let every child get the instruction where they're at. So, for example, you could have a lesson on whatever, and you could have some 5-year-olds ready for that lesson, some 7-year-olds who are ready, and some who aren't ready until they're 9. And that should be okay. They get that lesson when they're ready to learn that. Because kids, we all know, develop at different levels. So to say, okay, all 7-year-olds should learn X, Y, or Z is just ludicrous. Because some kids at 7 aren't ready, and some kids are ready for that lesson when they're 3. So I think part of the Tao is allowing those differences. And so one of the big structural differences is we would get rid of age-related classrooms where we put all the 7-year-olds in second grade or whatever, and we'd go to ungraded instruction, and we could use technology as the tool to be able to make that logistically possible.
We've been listening to Terry L. Hooper. She is a veteran teacher and an author of her book, Tao-Centered Schools. Terry, tell us how to get your book.
It's available on Amazon. It's available on barnesandnoble.com. And it's also available at Balboa Press. Or you can just Google Tao-Centered Schools with a hyphen between the words Tao and centered. And there's a few other online publishing companies that do carry it as well. So, I mean, it's readily available.
And Tao is spelled T-A-O. Well, thank you so much, Terry, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready to laugh along with This Little Parent Stayed Home with Ali Lopreet. Friday evenings at 6, 5 Central on TogiNet.com. This is a truly realistic, no-nonsense, tell-it-like-it-is method that will have you laughing and crying, surviving while struggling, and hammering away at the hardships as you travel through the greatest journey of your life. Get empowered by joining thousands of other parents who have also decided to take a leap of faith into a double career with longer hours and half the pay simply because of the love they have for their children. Together, we are rebuilding a new economy that will support us rather than enslave us. Never again will we have to choose between raising our children and earning to provide for them. It won't be easy, but it will be worth it. For more on Allie and her success, check out her website, OurMilkMoney.com. So come get empowered with This Little Parent Stayed Home with Allie Lopreek, Friday afternoons at 6, 5 Central on TogiNet.com.
People think I've made it. I'm popular. I seem happy all the time. I have great clothes and I'm involved in everything. But I have questions, doubts, and fears, just like every other teenager. That's why I'm glad for Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com.
The choices we have to make that can alter the course of our lives. Life is too much pressure if we try to go it alone. I tune in to Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell every week to get reminded that I'm not alone. Nicole Odell is an expert on what happens in the lives of teenagers. Join her as she deals with topics like peer pressure, purity, drugs, alcohol, and many other things that might come up along the way. She writes books and speaks to people all over the place, but she says her favorite moments are when she can pull up a chair and chat with teens about what's important to us.
For more information on Nicole and her books, go to NicoleOdell.com. Then join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com.
Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Brotherhood of the Red Nile, A Terrorist Perspective. And the author is Dan Perkins, and Dan joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to you by Abbott Press. Hello, Dan.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Everybody is going to be a different person after they hear this interview.
I hope so.
They're going to think about a lot of things differently because you are thinking outside the box, and unfortunately, this could really happen. And we're talking about a terrorist group, a new one, that you say is formed in central Syria, who's has a new alliance with the Iran nuclear program, and they somehow have gotten a hold of two suitcase nuclear dirty bombs. And, of course, they were once in the Soviet Union, and you get into that as well. But, of course, the whole plot here is they're going to use these suitcase bombs, these dirty bombs against the United States. And we'll also hear about this is a different type of terrorist, and it's the next generation of terrorists. And your book is very unique because you take it from the terrorist perspective and not from the United States perspective. And before we get into the details, though, Dan, there's a lot to talk about here. Let's find out about you, a little bit about your professional background, and where did this idea come from?
By profession, I'm a registered investment advisor in private practice. And what that means, I manage money for individuals and institutions, helping them figure out what to do with their money to meet specific goals and objectives, whether it's retirement or it's a trust or a foundation. But I'm independent and have been independent for most of the 40 years that I've been managing money. So because I'm independent, I'm able to do my own research, and I look at other research, but I've established a skill set being able to look at companies, take them apart, and put them back together to see what makes them tick, how do they operate, how do they function. And just about a year ago in November, I live on Sanibel Island in Florida, out in the Gulf of Mexico from Fort Myers. The Big Arts Center on our island, which is a cultural and education center, put out their flyer in November of 2011 for their winter 2012 programs. And in there was a course on writing mysteries and thrillers. And I've taken other courses, watercolors and acrylics and glass and clay. And I saw that and it kind of piqued my interest. So I took the class. And February 6th of 2012 was the first class. We walk in the door, and within 5 minutes, the teacher tells us, who's a published author, you're going to find out in 2 weeks whether you can be a writer or not. And I figured, this is great, because if I can't be a writer, I cross that off my bucket list and I go back and working on my golf game. I went home, and the first night I wrote 1,000 words.
Hmm.
And came back the following week and said to the instructor, says, I have a question. I said, after 1,000 words, would it be normal for a writer, remember, a writer becomes an author when somebody buys what they write, for a writer to know how a book would end? And she said, well, that depends on what you mean, how it ends. I said, I can see in my mind today what is the last line in the last paragraph on the last page. She said, no, that's not normal. Well, what happened was, when the book was finished 90 days later, it was 132,000 words, and the last chapter was exactly the way I told her it was the second Tuesday in February. I wish I could tell you, because I get this question asked all the time, where did the idea come from? Especially the idea of writing from a terrorist point of view. And if you read the book, there's some passion about by the terrorists. But these are unusual people. We have a Middle Eastern millionaire. We have a London School of Economics graduate. We have a petroleum engineer, and we have a nuclear scientist. These are not what we think of when we think of Al-Qaeda terrorists. This, as I say in the book, is another generation.
A think tank, as you put it.
Yes, they're a think tank. They're the first charge that their leader gives them is to look at all of the attacks that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had carried out against the United States, whether it was in the United States or outside the United States. And their job is to put their unique combination of skills together to try and figure out where he went wrong. And he's acquired somehow, I'm not going to tell you because it's in the book, but he's acquired two old Soviet Union suitcase 30 bombs, which are low-yield nuclear bombs. And he struck an agreement with the Iranian nuclear program to rebuild these into much more powerful bombs and use them against the United States. But once the four lieutenants have figured out what Al-Qaeda did wrong, he then gives them each the challenge to figure out how they would use the two bombs to create the maximum effect of what he's looking for against the United States. And the story is about the relationships, understanding who these men are, why they think the way they think. There's a love interest involved. And on the other side, if you would, is the United States, Homeland Security, who is trying to figure out, they've heard about these people, they're trying to figure out who they are, where they are, where they're going to attack. They get involved with the Israeli Mossad, who is dropped into Syria to spy on the Brotherhood, and it's full of twists and turns and surprises, and I just think it's a wonderful story. As I'm in book two, it's a three-book trilogy, and it's a continuation of the evolution of what happens in book one is in two, and what happens in two takes us into book three. So it's going to be three books that deal with this whole issue of a new level of terrorism that could be possible in the United States.
Well, you're going to expose, obviously, how vulnerable the United States is in this thriller. At the same time, did you do very much research for this?
I couldn't even begin to explain the amount of research.
Really?
There's just to give you an idea, as a writer, you want to let people have a good indication of what's going on. And they have to get this bomb from central Syria to Iran, and they have to cross over the border into Iraq, go through Iraq, and then get into the next, into Iran. And it took me many, many nights working with Google Maps and Google Earth satellite and MapQuest to try and figure out the route so I understood where they were going to go, where they would spend a night, I found the town. I would go in and do a search for hotels. I found a place that I thought would be a great site for a nuclear program. But the directions, which would take hours to articulate all the twists and turns, were covered in about two sentences in the book. There's a lot of interesting technology. One of them I thought was interesting that I didn't know anything about. They find this map in a house, and it's too large to go into their normal chamber at Homeland Security's forensic lab. And it's a map that's almost 4 foot by 6 foot. And the chief of the forensic and her two assistants are trying to figure out where can they put this map to see if they can lift fingerprints off. And they come to the conclusion, because Homeland Security is in Washington, D.C., that Georgetown University Hospital has a hyperbaric chamber that they can put the entire map in. And the process of understanding how they fume a map, it took hours and hours of research to figure out the process, how it works, but still be able to distill it down into simple language that people can understand. And people who have read the book tell me it's a great visual book. Hmm. You can see the dialogue and hear the dialogue between the characters. You can see the offices. You can see the labs. You can see the house. All of these things, you can see them in your mind's eye. So it's a great visual book.
Frank Williams is the Undersecretary of Homeland Security. Tell us about Frank. He sounds like one of the key characters.
He is. Frank Williams came from the CIA when Homeland Security was established, and his principal responsibility is to deal with possible terrorist threats in the United States. He has a very capable assistant who came with him from the CIA, Ted Baker. And they are the ones who are primarily trying to figure out what the Brotherhood is trying to do. And they draw upon all the resources of the United States government to try and help them figure out where the bombs are, how they're going to get into the United States, and where they're going to use them. And there is also a fabulous twist in that whole situation. So we look at Frank not only as his position of the undersecretary for terrorist activity, but Frank is married to Ellen. And as you get into the book and you understand, as he has a dialogue with Ellen, his wife, about what's going on at work, as a lot of husbands do have with their wives, you begin to get the sense of how afraid she becomes. And what I've done with Ellen as a character is given them a relationship, a loving and caring relationship, and she understands the limitations that she's going to have because of her husband's job. She works for the Social Security Administration. But Ellen, over time, especially in book two, becomes a surrogate for the American people's reaction to what's going to happen.
Well, it's very timely, obviously. The news is filled with reports about terrorism all over the world, and we know that terrorists are scheming everywhere to find ways to attack the U.S., so this book is too real. We have to remember it is fiction, but but it's too real, isn't it?
It creates I've had people tell me they read the book, that it's as if they're either watching a television movie or sitting in a theater watching a movie or watching television and looking at the news about what's going on. I happened to be in New York City at the time of September the 11th. I lived in outside of the city. And we had almost 13 people in our town that were killed in the World Trade Center bombings. And lots of little towns in New Jersey and Long Island and Connecticut lost those people, the 3,000 that died. I saw the devastation, and there were people, because of the collapse of the telecommunications infrastructure, that I couldn't get hold of for weeks, and I was concerned whether they were alive or dead. I suspect there's probably some of that, dealing with some of that in the book, in how I decided to write about it. It's a mystery to me how I sat down that first night and from nowhere started to write this story. And it's writing is an amazing process. Like I told you before, I could see the ending of the book within the first day.
Right.
I could start a chapter, and within one or two sentences of writing a chapter, if it was going to have a cliffhanger, I knew what the cliffhanger was going to be at the end of the chapter. It's just an amazing process. I feel blessed that for some reason I have this ability. I'm 67 years old. I didn't know it for the first 66 years, but I'm finding that I can write, I can scare people, I can entertain people. But really what you're saying is very important. When you read this book and you look at the four scenarios that are developed to choose from, you're going to look at those and you say, holy, all of these are very plausible.
Because your book really deals with real relationships between people under tremendous pressure.
Yes, absolutely. And the implications of fear and anxiety of what's happening and what could be happening, the fear of the unknown. When the president becomes very angry, when Williams cannot tell them for sure where they are, how many bombs they have, how powerful are they, and what do they plan to do with them? The president gets very angry, not so much at Williams as the messenger, but the message. How is it possible that this massive country, the United States, can be so helpless? And ultimately, they conclude that if they can't get to the bombs, we're going to have to deal with the consequences. And again, another huge twist about getting to the bombs, but I'm not going to give that away. but if you're a thriller reader, I make a promise in the beginning of the book, in the acknowledgments and the foreword, that if this wasn't one of the best thrillers you read in the last 5 years, I'll be very surprised.
Well, as Mark Walters, the professor of journalism at the University of South Florida, he wrote about your book, Somewhere Out There Lurking. This story makes those terrifying possibilities all too real. Once you start reading it, just try to put it down.
Right.
You can't say it better than that.
Yeah, I mean, that the reviews at Amazon.com are echoing his sentiment. Everybody's saying it's very difficult to put down. And so it's available in, right now because it's a brand new book. It's not even in all the catalogs yet. So we're fortunate enough here in Sanibel that you can buy it at the bookstores here. But you can buy it at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Amazon can give you the hard copy, the paperback, and the Kindle. And Barnes & Noble also has it in hard copy, paperback, and for their Nook. So it's an exciting read. We've got a website on the book. And for those people who are interested, they can go to the website and they can download the first 50 pages of the book for free to see. However, I've had a number of people who have sent me emails that they start reading the 50 pages and they stop after 12 or 15 because they know they're going to be there to the 50. And when they get to 50, there's no 51. They stop and order the book. So the website is www.danperkins.com. And it's not the ampersand or the at sign, but it's the word A-T, Sanibel, Sanibel.com. And you can see some speaking engagements listed there, and there's a wonderful photograph of my book and its cover on the Jumbotron in Times Square that you should look at in the photo section.
Well, thank you so much, Dan, for being with us. This looks like just one that we just have to add to the library.
I appreciate that. Thank you, sir.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Abbott Press.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.